This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up on the program, the Coalition's preparing for Parliament and there's the chance we'll see some new faces in senior positions. Also today, kidnapped by North Korea. The Japanese government's desperate for a breakthrough over missing citizens as Donald Trump heads to Tokyo. And is Australia's visa system working in some of our cities?
I've done my best to contribute to this city. I drive 12 hours some days, work for 60 hours a week, and I face all sorts of unfair treatment.
First, though, to an emotional departure outside 10 Downing Street. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, is resigning from the top job. And Conservative MPs who ushered Theresa May out the door are now jostling for the role. Mrs. May's announcement was praised as dignified, but her Brexit strategy is in tatters and her party split. So who'll take the reins now? Well, the leadership frontrunner is Boris Johnson, and he says the next British Prime Minister will need to put Brexit to bed. Europe correspondent Bridget Brennan filed this report from London.
A tearful Theresa May finally conceded her time at number 10 was up.
It is in the best interests of the country for a new Prime Minister to lead that effort. So I am today announcing that I will resign as leader of the Conservative and Unionist Party, the second female Prime Minister, but certainly not the last. I do so with no ill will, but with enormous and enduring gratitude to have had the opportunity to serve the country I love.
Some viewed her as a pragmatist seeking an impossible consensus, but many of her colleagues were baffled by her inability to read the room, bringing a failed Brexit deal to the Commons three times.
The Noes have it! The Noes have it! The Noes have it!
I have done everything I can to convince MPs to back that deal.
Mrs. May's predecessor, David Cameron, called her demise as Prime Minister desperately sad.
I mean, she worked incredibly hard. She's a dedicated public servant, and I know what it feels like when you come to realise that your leadership time has finished.
The Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, says Mrs. May botched Brexit and led a disastrous period of cuts in austerity.
One can understand the stress that she's going through, as any human being would be going through in this situation. But her description of the country is something that I don't recognise. When the UN produces a report that there are 14 million people in Britain living in poverty, when 130,000 children are living in insecure accommodation, then I think we've got to recognise there is a need for a change of direction in this country.
European leaders, though, lined up to pay tribute to Mrs. May, who spent months hammering out a divorce deal with the European Union. Leo Varadkar is the Irish Taoiseach.
I'm very sorry to hear of the resignation of Prime Minister May today. We'll certainly miss her. British politics is consumed by Brexit and will be consumed by Brexit for a very long time.
The US President Donald Trump will meet with Theresa May in her final week as British Prime Minister when he visits the UK on a state visit in a fortnight.
I feel badly for Theresa. I like her very much. She's a good woman. She worked very hard. She's very strong.
Now that she's going, one of Mrs. May's chief critics, the former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, praised Mrs. May's dignified statement. Mr. Johnson can now begin his campaign for the leadership, along with more than a dozen current and former ministers. At an event in Switzerland, he promised to take the UK out of the EU, with or without a deal, by the end of October, if he becomes Prime Minister. The EU maintains its position on Brexit will not budge. The deal it agreed with Mrs. May is the bloc's preferred path forward. This is Bridget Brennan in London for AM.
Well, this time last week, Australians were heading to the polls. Now the Prime Minister's setting up the coalition to begin its third term in office. Scott Morrison's expected to announce his cabinet tomorrow, and the reshuffle could see some new faces in senior positions. The coalition's also preparing for Parliament to resume, with the aim of getting its planned income tax cuts to a vote. I spoke earlier with our political reporter, Melissa Clark, and I began by asking just how different this new cabinet will look.
Well, the key positions are going to be stable. We know that Josh Frydenberg will remain as Treasurer and Matthias Cormann remain as Finance Minister. And the other key portfolios, Foreign Affairs and Home Affairs, will remain with Maurice Payne and Peter Dutton. And look, even Health and Education and the Attorney General's portfolio are likely to remain the same, staying with Greg Hunt and Dan Tehan and Christian Porter. This is really in keeping with the election campaign approach of warning against the risk of change. This post-election cabinet is going to look very similar to the pre-election cabinet. But there are going to be some changes, and many of them are really forced on the Prime Minister by the fact that he had quite a few retirements pre-election of some senior MPs, the likes of Christopher Pyne, Kelly O'Dwyer, Michael Keenan and Nigel Scullion.
Right, so who's likely to get a promotion to fill those gaps?
Well, Arthur Sinodinos is very likely to be returned to Cabinet. He had been in Cabinet previously but had to step down because of health issues. We can expect him to be back in Cabinet. Alan Tudge is probably one likely to be elevated from the outer ministry into Cabinet. He has held the portfolio around population and has been put in charge of the Prime Minister's favourite topic, congestion busting. So we can expect him to be elevated into Cabinet probably with that portfolio. We have had indications prior to the election that Linda Reynolds would be elevated from a junior defence portfolio into the defence minister's position, which would replace Christopher Pyne. And there is a certain expectation that the Indigenous Affairs portfolio, which has had been held by the retiring Nigel Scullion, could well go to Ken Wyatt. And if that were to happen, it would be the first time an Indigenous person has held the Indigenous Affairs portfolio. So that's a key change to look out for on the weekend. The other one is Susan Ley. The Prime Minister will want to ensure that there is still solid female representation, and the retirement of someone as senior as Kelly O'Dwyer and, of course, Julie Bishop means that we might well see some women promoted.
And the way forward is less clear for the Labor Party. How's the opposition 1 week on from its disastrous loss?
Well, in quite a different position from the coalition, which is appointing ministers, getting ready to push its legislation. The ALP is trying to arrange a new leader. It appears that Anthony Albanese will be the lone contender and therefore appointed as the new leader of the Labor Party. The leadership contest will be over quickly, but that doesn't necessarily mean everyone in the Labor Party is going to be happy with the outcome, because some in the party are worried that Anthony Albanese's ascension to the leadership might see a shift to the left, and they worry that's the wrong direction given they've just had a fairly big swing against them at the most recent election. So Anthony Albanese will be under pressure to stay in centre ground. There's a bit of a contest still to be sorted about who will be the deputy leader. It's most likely to be either Richard Marles or Claire O'Neill. They're both from the Victorian right, but it's possible that will be sorted out behind the scenes before it gets to chance to go to a ballot anyway. But look, really, the future for the Labor Party is wide open. They're reviewing their campaign, that's one part, but they're also reviewing their policies, and that's likely to be a pretty long and tortured process for the party.
Political reporter Melissa Clark there. Australia's visa system encourages new migrants to move to more remote areas of the country. It's meant to take pressure off our biggest cities and encourage economic growth elsewhere. But there's concern from some that the program isn't working everywhere. Carrington Clark has this report.
For most of the past 9 months, Apple Wong has made her income from driving people around Hobart.
You can get by driving Uber. You're in $15 an hour, you can get some food on your table, not a problem, pay the rent, but you don't have anything left.
This wasn't how she thought she'd pay the bills when she made the move to Tasmania. Apple Wong's originally from China. She first moved to Australia to finish an accounting degree in Melbourne. After graduating, she met with a migration agent who suggested she move to Tasmania on a regional skilled visa. But she found it impossible to find a professional job.
I've done my best to contribute to this city. I drive 12 hours some days, work for 60 hours a week, and I face all sorts of unfair treatment.
She's now found a new job, but it's in Adelaide, which, like Hobart, counts as a regional area in the skilled migration program.
I am actually quite a bit overwhelmed. Not that I can't do it, I'm always quite adaptive. You see, I moved from China to Singapore, Singapore to Melbourne, Melbourne to Tassie, Tassie now to Adelaide.
Australia's immigration system encourages workers to move to areas classified as regional. It's designed to plug holes in the workforce and stimulate economic growth. But a demographer from the University of Tasmania, Lisa Denny, says it's creating problems in her state.
These skilled migrants often have difficulty finding employment that matches, particularly matches their qualification, but also the cost of living is high. The ability to get jobs with the amount of hours that they want to work is often very difficult for people to do. So they spend their time here in Tasmania, that they get their points for their visa, and then it's often that they need to move.
In the bigger states, the term regional means areas outside the major cities. But all of the Northern Territory, South Australia and Tasmania are classified as regional, including their capitals. So in Tasmania, the majority of migrants who move to the state move to Hobart, an area where low population growth isn't an issue. Lisa Denny says it's exacerbating a housing crisis.
We are in a critical area of housing stress for Tasmanians, and that is attributed to population growth being driven by migration-led growth.
The business community supports the program. Michael Bailey is the chief executive of the Tasmanian Chamber of Commerce and Industry. He says it's disappointing that Apple Wong had to leave Tasmania.
To me, it seems astounding that a qualified accountant has had to move to another state, you know, to find work. To me, that's a failing of internal processes within Tasmania.
He says the state needs more high-skilled migrants, but admits it's difficult getting the right skills.
Certainly in Tasmania, we need to be clearer on the sorts of roles that are needed, but I think equally we need to work harder as communities to break down, you know, the barriers that are clearly in front of people with skills, whether they be from migrant or from local backgrounds.
Alison O'Neill is the chief executive of the Tasmanian Migrant Resource Centre. She says there are often unrealistic expectations about how easily migrants will find work.
As you'd expect, just stepping off the plane into another state requires you to have some sort of level of support. You need to know where to live, who to connect with, what communities that you need to be part of. A getting job is part of that process.
Michael Bailey from the Chamber of Commerce and Industry says he would support hiving off Hobart from the regional visa system to encourage migrants to move to smaller towns.
We've seen the population of Hobart increase significantly over the last few years, and the remainder of Tasmania hold stable or decrease a little bit. So, you know, very much so, we need to begin to look at Tasmania differently from metropolitan to regional.
In a statement to the ABC, a spokesperson from the Department of Home Affairs says that under new visa categories, which are being introduced from November this year, there will be greater incentives for regional employers to nominate skilled workers.
Carrington Clark with that report. The US President Donald Trump will tonight touch down in Tokyo for a four-day trip, and the Japanese government has spared no expense. Amid escalating trade tensions with China and Japan, as well as the North Korea issue, the visit comes at a crucial time in the close relationship. And the Japanese government is desperate for a breakthrough over the issue of its citizens kidnapped by Pyongyang. Their families are hoping the US can open some doors. North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer reports from Tokyo.
It's been more than 40 years since Megumi Yokota vanished from her seaside village in central Japan. At just 13, she was kidnapped on her way home from school by North Korean agents. Her brother Takuya thinks about his sister often.
She was such an energetic girl. She loved to have a chat. She was curious about everything. My brother and I always thought of her as a sunflower, as she was such a bright girl. Then, when she suddenly disappeared, it felt like everything became dark in the family.
Megumi is one of at least 17 Japanese citizens kidnapped by North Korean spies in the 70s and 80s. In a cruel twist, the North said Megumi had committed suicide in North Korea, but the ashes they sent back to the family weren't hers.
Adding to the crime of abduction, North Korea took someone else's bones and created another crime. I feel North Korea is an atrocious country that constantly violates human rights.
Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has made resolving the abduction issue a keystone of his political career, but he has yet to set up talks with Kim Jong-un. Until this month, he refused to consider meeting the North Korean leader without the promise of significant progress on the kidnappings. Now he's prepared to meet unconditionally. The problem is, there's been no indication that Kim Jong-un is willing to meet Prime Minister Abe, and that's where the families are hoping Japan's good relationship with Donald Trump may be able to help. Professor at Temple University in Japan, Jeffrey Kingston, says a big part of this visit will be all about making sure Shinzo Abe is inside the tent on any US decision-making.
More importantly, I think, is the issue of North Korea's nuclear missile program. And what he's very concerned about is that perhaps Trump might cut a deal. And the deal would leave intact certain capabilities that would still be threatening to Japan. And so he wants to, I think, you know, make sure that there's common understanding on that.
Tokyo is doing all it can to keep President Trump happy on this visit. He'll be the first foreign leader to meet Japan's new emperor. He and Abe will watch the sumo together, and the US leader will even present a cup to the winner. Japan has rolled out the diplomatic red carpet for this visit, and it has to. Amid growing isolation in the region, Tokyo needs all the friends it can get. This is Jake Sturmer in Tokyo, reporting for AM.
Turning to Papua New Guinea now, where the Prime Minister Peter O'Neill is facing a serious threat to his grip on power. One of the government's key coalition partners and several ministers have walked out on the government and joined a group of opposition MPs. It's calling itself the Alternate Government. And for the past month, there have been several high-profile defections to the opposition group, which is now claiming to have the numbers it needs to take control of Parliament. A potential change in government could have impacts for Australia, as PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
For almost a month, disaffected MPs in Papua New Guinea have been gathering in a hotel in Port Moresby and planning to remove the country's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill. Just days before Parliament returns, their numbers have been bolstered.
I'd like to welcome the Honourable William Duma, Parliamentary Leader of the United Resource Party.
William Duma is the State Enterprises Minister and leader of the second biggest party in the ruling coalition.
This camp have considered everything carefully, and we have decided that it is in the best interest of the people that we represent back home.
Among the latest MPs to swap sides are the Police Minister and the Higher Education Minister.
Welcome to Laguna.
Mr. Duma's decision to move to the opposition represents a significant power shift. He was welcomed to the fold by opposition leader Patrick Pruetch.
We're looking forward to the next few days to meet each other and, more importantly, putting our thoughts together to give that confidence back to our country.
The Alternate Government, as the group is calling itself, now claims to have 62 MPs in its camp, which would give it a majority in Parliament. Peter O'Neill's former finance minister, James Morape, has been a key figure in the revolt.
And to take this country away from greed by corporate citizens and greed by individual citizens. And that's what we're all about.
When Parliament sat almost 3 weeks ago, the opposition bloc fell short of the numbers it needed. The government held on to a 9-seat majority, with Mr. Duma's party all on board. Mr. O'Neill used his numbers to adjourn Parliament after just half a day of sitting. When Parliament returns on Tuesday, Mr. Morape says this time the numbers they're claiming will materialise.
Our camp now stands at 62 in the House.
A change in government could impact Australian projects in PNG, including the refugees and asylum seekers being kept on Manus Island. This week, the Leader of the Opposition called on Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison to urgently relocate the remaining men. But Papua New Guinea is known as the land of the unexpected. Politics in the country is notorious for its fluidity and unpredictability. So, what will happen in the days and hours leading up to Parliament sitting remains to be seen.
May God bless Papua New Guinea.
This is Natalie Whiting in Port Moresby reporting for Saturday AM.
Well, this week, the Reserve Bank gave its strongest indication yet that official interest rates will be cut as early as next month. And on top of that unusually direct signal from the RBA, the banking regulator APRA says it plans to relax some of the guidelines banks use to determine how much they can lend to customers. So what does that mean for the economy, and will it do anything to stem the current housing correction? I spoke earlier with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, who spent a few decades now covering the Reserve Bank. So I asked him if he was surprised that there'd been such a direct signal that rates were about to be cut.
Well, Tom, I don't think I've ever seen the Reserve Bank use such direct language in signalling that rates are about to be cut. But this was an explicit and clear easing bias in the minutes that we saw on Tuesday. And normally we go into these lockups at the Reserve Bank and spend so much time deciphering the jargon, comparing one statement to another, looking for tiny changes in languages or nuances. And often I just go to the end of the statement, and that's where they often bury the lead.
Right.
But this time it was quite clear, and later in Philip Lowe's speech, he said that the key boxes of very low inflation and rising unemployment had been ticked, and it was clear that those requirements and the central scenario of an economic improvement wasn't really looking that great, and an easing of a cash rate would be appropriate. So a clear switch to that easing bias after 30 meetings of really no change, and that's what surprised observers. And when I last checked, there was a 95% chance that the cash rate will be cut to 1.25% on June the 4th when the Reserve Bank Board next meets.
Right, but what are the risks in cutting rates to a new historic low, especially with the chance that the cash rate might eventually go below 1%?
Well, the big risk is that with the cash rate already at a record low of 1.5%, there's not really much of a buffer until you hit zero, and that by cutting rates too quickly and too deeply, the ammunition would be used, and there's not much left to deal with something like a global shock out of China, for example, the US going into recession, or even something like the US spat with Iran turning into something a bit more serious. So there's a view that fiscal policy levers such as the tax cuts that were promised in the budget could be used, or infrastructure spending to spur economic growth. And the businessman Graham Bradley, who I spoke to earlier in the week, he's currently the chairman of HSBC Australia, says the RBA should wait for a further deterioration in the economy, and you really don't want to get into a situation of the 0% interest rates or close to zero that we saw at the height of the global financial crisis.
And looking at what's been happening in recent times, the banking regulator APRA says it plans to ease some of the norms banks use to assess loan applications. But this time last year, they were tightening up guidelines to make it harder for investors to get loans.
Yes, and this was the big surprise, Tom. And what APRA is looking at is removing the current serviceability buffer. That's where someone goes in to borrow for a home, and they have to prove they can repay that loan if mortgage rates go up to 7%. Now, with the RBA's cash rate so low, APRA wants to install a 2.5% buffer above a bank's mortgage rate so they can assess serviceability. And as you referred to, strangely, this comes at a time of tighter lending standards in the wake of the Banking Royal Commission last year, where banks have been self-regulating to tighten up their procedures. But it also might be an admission that tighter lending standards went a bit too far, and that the big regulators, the RBA and APRA, are now really worried that lower consumption from the housing correction could really start to hurt the economy without a stimulus boost.
The ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. A re-emergence of dengue fever in central Queensland has led to a full outbreak response, which is set to continue into the weekend. For the first time in decades, a locally acquired case of the disease, which has spread from mosquitoes, has been confirmed in Rockhampton. But one expert says there's now a higher risk of dengue fever in places like Rockhampton compared to the more tropical parts of Queensland further north. Gavin Coote has this report.
Be alert, not alarmed. That was the message when health authorities began knocking on doors in Rockhampton's north. After a person was diagnosed with dengue fever in the area, there have been swift efforts to limit the spread of the type of mosquito which transmits the illness. Paul Florian is from Central Queensland Health.
It's quite surprising. People don't realise
Wearwater Pond. So things like plants where there might be a fork in a tree trunk or something, palm fronds on the ground that have fallen and we've had rain and they have some water in it. Those are fantastic places for these mosquitoes to inhabit and lay eggs.
The Aedes aegypti mosquito is responsible for the spread of the disease. And while common in parts of central Queensland, he says locally acquired cases are extremely rare.
We do have sporadic imported cases. People have been overseas and come back crook and been tested, and we find that they had contracted dengue while they've been on their holiday. But we have never, in my time here, which is over 17 years, had a local transmission of dengue in Rockhampton or central Queensland.
Health authorities began knocking on doors yesterday. So far, they visited 80 homes and businesses, warning people to take precautions and offering pesticide. Tamara Bahaja is an adjunct research fellow at the James Cook University in Cairns.
Australia has very good vector control and vector surveillance. We're very good at keeping these types of things under control. But it is important never to just completely relax, as has been illustrated by this case.
But as Rockhampton remains the focus of a concerted response, dengue fever appears to be almost fully eradicated from centres further north, where it's traditionally been most common. An outbreak of the virus in Townsville in 2009 led to hundreds of cases of illness and one fatality. But Dr. Bahaja points to the success of recent programs there, where the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes are infected with a bacteria, Wolbachia, making it difficult to transmit the virus.
Places like Rockhampton and other central parts of Queensland where we do have the vector, but there's no program where the mosquitoes haven't been replaced with Wolbachia mosquitoes, they are at risk still of having outbreaks.
She hopes the proactive work by authorities in Rockhampton will ensure no further cases of dengue fever are confirmed, a view shared by Paul Florian at Central Queensland Health. He's gearing up for further door knocks today and collecting larvae for further inspection.
The area is mostly suburban, so we'll continue with visiting domestic dwellings and talking to people. And if there are other types of premises in that target zone, well, we'll certainly be visiting those as well.
Paul Florian from Central Queensland Health and Gavin Coote with that report. Now to a collection of lost paintings that have mysteriously turned up in a New South Wales country hospital. Now, a large collection of paintings by artist Pixie O'Harris were actually unearthed in an old storeroom at the hospital last year, but another eight were still missing, and that led to a wide-scale search. Well, guess what? They've been found simply appearing one day with the rest of the collection, and the whole series is now being restored, as Emma Siossian reports.
So you want another easel?
Janine Roberts made the surprise discovery at the Manning Base Hospital in Taree on the New South Wales mid-north coast.
I started looking at them going, this is them, this is the missing ones. I was so excited.
The eight paintings turned up in an office with no note or explanation.
I went to ask people at the hospital, of course, where did they come from, you know, and nobody could give me an answer. They had just magically appeared. And I thought, well, I'm going to leave it at that. And I think there's a little bit of pixie magic happening here.
The Fairy Star murals were painted in 1957 as part of a series to brighten hospital children's wards, health centres and schools across New South Wales. Janine Roberts and fellow Taree resident Penny Tierman became aware of the local public hospital collection after it was mentioned in an old newspaper clipping they found. Penny Tierman says they then set about trying to find the paintings.
We thought this is something that really should be uncovered. We really should follow up on this time. And this is where it all started.
They found a large collection in an old hospital storeroom last year, and four works were still on the walls, but eight paintings were missing. The two women put out a call on social media, but it turned up nothing.
I think our greatest fear was that we just couldn't find the full set, and we thought, honestly, that they had perhaps deteriorated over the years and had gone to the tip.
So when the rest of the collection mysteriously appeared months later, Janine Roberts says she couldn't believe it.
I actually got really emotional because we had some of the titles of the missing paintings from old newspapers, and so as soon as I saw Olaf's painting of Childhood Dreams, It was very obvious that was the title that went with that painting, and I thought, they're all here, and I started counting them and looking through, so it was very exciting.
Now that the entire collection is back together, they'll feature in an exhibition next year. Rowena Evans, the granddaughter of Pixie O'Harris, is looking forward to the exhibition.
She was always creating something. She loved children and she was very keen on making any stay in hospital more fun, less traumatic for them. That's why she was so keen on doing pictures in hospitals.
Volunteers are now helping restore the paintings back to their former glory.
I mean, look at the expression on those bears. And all the children are lit. Just illuminates the faces and makes them really appealing.
A series of works done for Sydney's Fairfield Hospital will also be included in the local Tari exhibition after a nurse found them also tucked away in a storeroom. The exhibition curator, Sue Mitchell, says it's a rare thing to have a full series of Pixie and Olaf O'Harris hospital paintings.
It's like finding lost treasure. As soon as I look at these works, I think of the 1950s. The children are dressed in that style. And they're very innocent looking. It's just delightful.
Curator Sue Mitchell and that report from Emma Siossian. That's Saturday AM for today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.